Hello, readers. Welcome to The Right Kind of Book Talk. I'm your host, Stacey Wright. This is episode 15, A Journey Through Literary Darkness, Books Under a Cloud of Controversy. What books have the kind of marketing no author wants? I was watching a heated debate with a group of readers about the book American Dirt. Being the kind of person I am, I didn't add my two cents to the insanity, but it did make me wonder, what books out there have been overshadowed by negative connotations? Now, I went to Facebook and I wasn't expecting the influx of books and authors that were actually surrounded in controversy. Now, I do swear I do not live under a rock, but somehow I had missed a boatload of drama. And a part of me is kind of grateful, but the other part of me wonders what else I've missed out on. The drama and controversy surrounding It Ends With Us and the legal troubles that both the main stars are having has brought to the surface some troubling things about the author of the book, Colleen Hoover. But before we dive into the dark world of literacy, let's see what books you can grab from the bookstore today. That's right, it's publication day. Rebel Witch, this is book two of the Crimson Moth Saga by Kristin Ciccarelli, I think that's right. Ciccarelli. And it's a romantasy. The Dressmaker of London by Julia Kelly. And that one is a World War II historical fiction. I like the author. Never Planned on You by Lindsay Hammerhoff. And it's a contemporary romance. I Got Abducted by Aliens and Now I'm Trapped in a Rom-Com by Kimberly Lemming. And okay, it's basically an alien smut book, okay? Which I did not know until I read it. Okay, so you've been warned. Cold as Hell by Kelly Armstrong. And this is book three in Haven Rock Saga. It's a mystery thriller. Okay, it's not one of my favorite series by this author. It's a spin-off from another series that I did enjoy. But for some reason, this one just isn't grasping me, but maybe you love it. Maya and Natasha by Elise Durham. And it's a Russian historical fiction. This one's actually on my radar pretty damn hard. A Curse for the Homesick by Laura Brooke Robson. And it's an adult fantasy book. I Am the Cage by Alison Sweet Grant. And it's a young adult contemporary fiction. Some pretty cool books out today. Okay, so now on to Colleen Hoover and the insanity that unfolded on TikTok. And every single transgression has literally come to the surface because those TikTokers do better digging than the FBI, no matter how fast somebody can scrub the internet. Now, I highly doubt that Colleen Hoover, who has since deleted her Instagram and then reactivated it, sans post she wanted to distance herself from, honestly believed that this backlash would take out her legs too. But my favorite TikTok sleuths wonder why she picked a side, especially when allegations of sexual harassment were made against her own son. I found everything online, and I will use the word allegedly because obviously I can't know the actual truth. So Colleen's son Levi came into the public eye in 2022 after sexual harassment allegations surfaced against him on social media. Colleen addressed the allegation in a private Facebook group to clear the air. So there was an initial tweet on February 12, 2022, which has since been deleted, and a Twitter user with the handle at TheoNotLoveBot contributed to a thread against Colleen Hoover's writing. Her son also sexually harassed me, and she blocked me when I spoke up about it to her. In a second tweet, she elaborated, saying, long story short, we were friends on Snapchat, and I'm assuming she meant sext, like sex texting. Like every day we would message because we're friends, right? And like this was when I was 16 and he was fully aware of how old I was because I always talked about the fact I was still in school. She provided now deleted screenshots with evidence that she had messaged Colleen Hoover on Instagram explaining the situation and proof she was friends with Levi, Colleen's son, with the screenshots of his Snapchat handle. So her son at the time was 21, 22, and this is quite troubling. Regardless of whether or not there was sexual messaging, what need does an adult have to be messaging someone he doesn't know and who is a child online. Now, Colleen denies anything happened, and I guess we will never know the truth here, but let's, for argument's sake, say that this isn't true, okay? That it was all just a big drama. Now, Colleen Hoover writes books that romanticizes abuse. The biggest point of contention among many when it comes to Hoover is how she depicts abuse in her books. Abuse is a delicate subject, okay, and needs to be written in a fragile manner. However, many detractors of the author think she is very flippant on the subject and any feedback regarding her depiction of it. Following the release of It Ends With Us, the novel, and the public outcry over its subject matter, Colleen's next move was to create a coloring book based on the book. Okay. As well as a makeup line centered around the best-selling novel, which further glorified the abusive relationship as this story's center in the eyes of many. Fans took to social media to pick apart the It Ends With Us merchandising strategy, calling it in poor taste, given the subject matter. Yeah, it was tacky. I'm not going to lie. It was as tacky as all hell. Now, I have read the book, and honestly, I don't think Colleen Hoover is a particularly gifted author. It's End With Us was okay, and so was its sequel, and I only watched the movie out of morbid curiosity. And honestly, I only got about halfway through the movie before I turned it off. Look, I've lived through domestic violence myself, okay? I understand the dangers of making men seem alluring when they are abusive in books. It could put someone with no life experiences into danger because of this unrealistic romantic notion that books like Colleen's make girls think is real romance. Oh, he's so jealous because he never loved anyone this much before. Or he wants to know where I am at all times because he's so worried for my safety. No, these are controlling behaviors. Tracking your phone, controlling. Checking through your text messages. It's all abuse. And making girls with no idea what frightening behaviors look like because they idolize the men in these books, thanks to authors like Hoover. Now, that's problematic within itself, but that's not really on the author. But should it be? It's like a bartender who gives a drink to someone who's driving. Are they liable if that drunk person runs someone over? Yeah. So I wonder where the buck stops. Abuse isn't just getting physically hit. It's so much more than that. Now, this is just some food for thought. These are just me spitballing my ideas out there. But as somebody who got trapped by a man not understanding what abuse looked like, I'm really fearful that sometimes these books make women believe that, oh, he loves me, so it's okay. And they do stupid things they wouldn't necessarily have done if they hadn't have thought that maybe the idea of it was more romance than abuse. While we stick to this line of thought, let's move on to Bryn Greenwood. And she wrote a book called All the Ugly and Wonderful Things. Now, I have never read this book or even heard of this author until now. So what is this book about? A beautiful and provocative love story between two unlikely people and the hard-won relationship that elevates them above the Midwestern meth lab backdrop of their lives. Okay. As the daughter of a drug dealer, Wavy knows not to trust people, not even her own parents. It's safer to keep her mouth shut and stay out of sight. Struggling to raise her little brother, Donnell, 8-year-old Wavy is the only responsible adult around. Obsessed with the constellations, she finds peace in the starry night sky above the fields behind her home, until one night she is stargazing and it causes an accident. After witnessing his motorcycle wreck, she forms an unusual friendship when one of her father's thugs, Kellen, a tattooed ex-con with a heart of gold. By the time Wavy is a teenager, her relationship with Kellen is the only tender thing in a brutal world of addicts and debauchery. When tragedy rips Wavy's family apart, a well-meaning aunt steps in, and what is beautiful to Wavy looks ugly under the scrutiny of the outside world. All right, so surface, it's already pricked me a little bit. So I did some diving into the reviews and the online content I could find, and this is what I found. So Kellen steps in as a father figure to Wavy at the age of 8. and he's in his 20s. So instead of remaining her protector, he took full advantage of her inability to separate fatherly love from sexual advances. Now, Callan isn't an evil predator, but also he isn't Wavy's savior. So the book basically romanticizes grooming. Like I said, I haven't read the book, but what I am understanding, so Bryn does an interview on all the ugly and wonderful things, and she basically has these things to say. Now, these are her words, okay? This is not me talking, all right? Okay, her. One of the things that I talked about in the interview is the fact that our laws are all necessity based on very black and white ideas of right and wrong, and that we have to acknowledge gray areas. We want the issue of underage sex to be so clear-cut that no decent person could get involved in it. That's the way we like to see it in the news, some great moral in the moral foundation. We want to believe that we stand on one side, the right side, and squint towards the other side, the one where pedophiles gather in the shadows. I say that as someone who's not only existed in a grey area, but who also thrived in it and was happy in that grey area. When I was a young teenager, I was in a loving relationship with a much older man. That relationship was consensual. It was consenting and it was a secret. Not just while I was in it, but also when I was an adult. Obviously, it was secret at the time because it was illegal. But why did it continue to be secret long after it was over and long after I was an adult? I kept it a secret because I got tired of having people overwrite my narrative. There were well-meaning people who were more comfortable shaming me than believing that I had been capable of consent. Prior to the release of this novel, I'd only told a few people about that relationship, and every time was disastrous. One intimate partner, the one who had goaded me into talking about my earliest sexual experiences, told me, "You're wrong. You were a victim, and that man was a pedophile." I'm sorry, I kind of agree with that. He's a pedophile. It was devastating to be told that my personal feelings were irrelevant. In many ways, it was as terrible as the time I tried to report a sexual assault, and the police sent me home without writing down a word after they calmly informed me that I actually hadn't been raped. They weren't even two sides of the same coin. They were the same side of the coin. I was being silenced and robbed of my narrative agency. You were a victim. You weren't a victim. You don't even know what happened to you. Except I did. Of course I did. Okay. This is disturbing on so many levels, okay? So because she was a 13-year-old having sex with an adult, so a much, much older adult, and she liked it, she doesn't believe there was anything wrong with it and that she could fully consent to understanding what she was getting herself into. Right here, she is saying a child can consent and she doesn't believe there is anything wrong with it. And then writes a book labeling it romance. Look, I don't know about you, but without reading the book, this feels 100 degrees of nasty, okay? Maybe it's not written the way it sounds. Who the F knows? But what I do know is that no matter how you feel about something, we have laws for a reason, and that is to protect the vulnerable. And your ability to decide what applies to you doesn't make you right. Imagine if that was her daughter. Now, I have requested the book from the library because I try not to make assumptions about books without reading them first. But her interview was kind of scathing, don't you think? And she believes that kids can consent to sex with adults, and that is quite terrifying for this mama. Okay. Now, if you're interested in her interview, it was called Consent Secrets and Bearing of My Soul on Public Radio. Okay. If you Google it, you can find it because that's how I found it. Okay. So right there, we have an author that makes abusive men sound romantic and another making groomers sound romantic. And they promote these books and millions of people read them. That's the kind of reach these books have. Now, a lot of people felt gross after reading all the ugly and beautiful things, and yet others found it profound and rather eye-opening. Yikes. Okay, so next, The Help by Catherine Stockett. This one broke my dang heart, okay? Abilene Cooper, who sued author Catherine Stockett for a mere $75,000 for taking her story as the basis for her character, Abilene, had her lawsuit dismissed because of an elapsed statute of limitations. Okay, so that's what happened. Abilene Cooper, the longtime nanny for Stockett's brother, had filed a $75,000 lawsuit against the author, claiming she was upset by the book that characterized black maids working for white families in the family's hometown of Jackson, Mississippi, during the 1960s. Okay. Cooper also once babysat for Stockett's daughter, according to the Jackson Clarion Ledger, that's a newspaper. And the lawsuit alleges that she had been assured by Stockett, 42, that her likeness would not be used in the book. The 2009 novel was an instant favorite among book clubs. I loved it. Written in the voice of black help by a woman raised by maids herself, and who is white. Now, Cooper, 60 years old, maintains that the book's fictional character, Abilene Clark, is her. She says the alleged unauthorized appropriation of her name and image, and it was emotionally upsetting. And her employers, Carol and Robert Stockett III, they agreed with the maid. He is Catherine Stockett's brother and employs Cooper as a nanny and a maid. Cooper said the portrayal of Abilene as an almost saintly figure is who is subjected to racial prejudices of the period is embarrassing. This is bad enough, okay? I love this book. And now I know that she stole someone's story and didn't even thank them or credit them or pay them. I feel really bloody dirty. Now, did Stockett exploit an African-American woman for money? Well, that's how it looks, isn't it? That's how it's coming across to me. Reading through what Abilene had to say, it sure sounds like she is guilty, and then she got away with it. But while we are here, let's talk about the problems arising from white authors writing these kinds of books on people of color in the first place. I had to take a look at this book from other angles. She basically wrote a book about black maids who have a white savior. So she wrote a book about black women for a white audience. Now, I never saw a problem with authors writing books outside of what they are. Until like now. Personally, I saw Abilene as the hero of the book and not Skeeter, but I can kind of see how this might look to other people now. Men write books about women. Women have male characters. Asian writers have white characters. It's all fiction. It's all creative license. But I kind of felt a little shift in myself after reading how the real Abilene felt and how the author dismissed her as well. Now, I kind of wanted to go back and read the book again, but I can't bring myself to. Someone actually posted a lot of quotations from the book online, and I can see just how racist some of them are. They're offensive, stereotypical. And it's funny how your viewpoint can actually change over the years, because like mine really has. And it also felt like a ripoff of How to Kill a Mockingbird, but she didn't learn the do's and don'ts from a book written over 60 years ago. A book that was supposed to be about racial injustice and racial inadequacies by a white person for white people. And I think that really sums it up. But moving on, I did bring up the book American Dirt by Janine Cummins. This controversy I knew at the time of reading, and I read it anyway because I didn't care. The author, who identified as white, although her grandmother was from Puerto Rico, had indulged in stereotypes and didn't accurately portray the truth of migrant experiences. A conversation arose about who has the right to tell a story, and that conversation actually continues today. It was likened to trauma porn. I think that's a bit much, but that's just my opinion. I think the biggest thing here is that had a Mexican person wrote the book, would it have been published? Would it have had the same marketing budget? Would it have been paid the same? And honestly, I'm not here to debate that. I know there is a lot about white authors being paid more because more of their books sell. Isabella Allende. She's a Chilean American who has an excellent track record of book sales. So that's neither here nor there. I'm more concerned about whether this book is controversial. This book highlighted how dangerous it is to cross the border. And maybe she didn't do a brilliant job of it, but she started a conversation. There were books that were written by Mexicans about this. They didn't get the narrative out, did they? Her book did. It led me to read Unaccompanied by Javier Zamora. I would never have found that book if I hadn't read hers first, okay? This is the problem I have with assuming only Mexicans can write about it. What makes you think they have any better first-hand knowledge? Skin tone should have zero bearing on a book's ability to invoke a reaction, start a conversation, and envelop change. And sometimes it takes something like this book to get us to where we need to go. I found quite a few Mexican authors after American Dirt. And this makes it less about whether she should have written it or whether she did enough research to stop the critics getting their panties in a wad. I feel like if she had collaborated with people who did have first-hand knowledge and they had profited as well, this book wouldn't even be on my radar for this, would it? Fiction is fiction, people. I wish we could keep it where it needs to be. It's getting quite irritating that people feel that fiction needs to be realistic. You want realism? Go pick up a non-fiction book. The reason it's called fiction is because it means it's not true. So can we start learning what these genres actually mean and stop getting your panties bunched up over things that are really out of your scope? You know, this episode's really starting to get to me. Some of my favorite books have hit this episode, okay? Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens. This was a breakout book and people were talking about it everywhere and I absolutely loved it. Okay, not the movie so much, but the book, heck yes. Now, a lot of people felt she was rather heavy-handed in her writing and didn't leave a lot to the imagination. Whatever. Now, the real controversy surrounds her time in Zambia and the fact she's still wanted for questioning over a murder that took place there. Okay, I'm gonna lay it out for you. So in 1996, ABC debuted a special that centered on Owens and her husband at the time, Mark Owens, and a tragic incident in Zambia where they were working as conservationists. The special, Deadly Game, the Mark and Delia Owens story, captured escalating tensions between the couple and poachers. In the episode, an alleged poacher was shot and killed on camera. The cameraman who filmed the incident told Goldberg that he believed Owens' stepson, Christopher Owens, committed the murder. The author told Goldberg in 2010 that her stepson was not present when the man was shot. Mark, Delia, and Christopher Owens are still wanted for questioning because there is no statute of limitations on murder in Zambia. After the special aired in 1996, the Zambian government opened a police investigation. The body was never found. A cameraman claimed that the author's stepson, Christopher Owens, was the one who fired the gun. Delia Owens has publicly denied this, saying that Christopher was not present at the scene. People say Chris did this because they got confused, because the cameraman was also named Chris. Okay, that's what Owens told Goldberg for his 2010 New Yorker piece. There have been no charges against the Owenses, but this hasn't stopped people talking. Whether you believe it or not is irrelevant, because readers made it loud and clear that they would not support her books after all this. And she really hasn't released anything. It's been like 6 years and nothing is in the works. She may well have been dropped by her publisher. I actually really have no idea. All I know is that skunk spray doesn't wash off so easy. And this is still something that's discussed today. Okay, I'm going to warn you right now. This book did come up too. And it might be a little bit triggering, so please be mindful, okay? So this book was called Me Before You by Jojo Moyes. The book features a quadriplegic and he wanted to die because living isn't something he wants to continue doing in a body he can't move. So basically the idea is that you're better to be dead than to be disabled. And that's what come up a lot surrounding this book. And people felt that Jojo Moyes was basically saying that disabled people wanted to die or they weren't worth having around to keep alive. I really don't think that was what she was trying to say at all, but who knows? Most of the vocal detractors have been people with disabilities. Their main critique is that the book perpetuates the stereotype that living with a disability is not worth living. For some people, that is true. They don't feel their life is worth living. Now, I didn't record this episode last week, which is really funny, because my own disability had me resting for the week. I have something called rheumatoid arthritis, and it's an autoimmune disease. Now, I usually keep it pretty well managed, but I can't help when it flares up. It literally feels like I get broken glass in my joints, and I couldn't breathe. I get hurt to breathe. Now, I couldn't imagine living like this on a daily basis. So you don't get to decide what's personal to you, how you feel about it, okay? I have two kids with ASD. They have severe communication and behavioral issues. They likely will never live alone. And I live in Canada where they want to expand our MAID program to include mental health disorders. That's you know, assisted suicide. People got very upset over a fictionalized book and movie, and yet the real world ramifications are that a government is willing to keep people for a fee. People who may have anxiety or depression can apply, and the government will pay $1 million to kill them instead of putting that money into actual help. I don't see these advocates coming out against the government, but I digress. People like to get their knickers in a twist over literature, fiction. But when it comes to reality, there's crickets. I actually think you should read this book, but grab some Kleenex and some chocolates because you're going to need it. We won't shy away from JoJo Moyes just yet because she was at the center of another controversy. And this one is the cardinal sin of publishing, plagiarism. Now, this one all stems around a novel she released called The Giver of Stars. She was accused of plagiarizing a book called The Women of Troublesome Creek, which was written by Kim Michelle Richardson. Okay, so both of these books share a similar historical setting and focus on the Pack Horse Library Project in Kentucky. However, just so you know, there was never any legal action taken against Moyes, and her publisher denies any prior knowledge of Richardson's book. So here are the key points about the controversy. Similar subject matter. Okay, so both books explore the real-life Pack Horse Library Project, where women delivered books on horseback to Appalachian communities. There were timing concerns, okay, because the book Women of Troublesome Creek was published several months before The Giver of Stars, leading to accusations that Moyes may have been aware of Richardson's work. There was no legal action taken, okay? And while Richardson did raise concerns about plagiarism, her publisher, Source Books, investigated and ultimately decided not to pursue legal action, okay? Moyes' defense. She maintains that she was unaware of Richardson's books and discovered the Pack Horse Library Project through independent research. Now, there is a part in both books where the main female character both come across a homeless person and are attacked, which never actually happened in history. So it made people wonder how both these authors came up with a similar idea. Okay, I can understand that. I can totally get that. Now, I have read both books. I agree that the subject is obviously the same. But the way the books are written couldn't have been more different. The tones are world apart. And the stories they tell are not even close. The only thing they have in common is the fact that they both use the horse library, and she doesn't have dibs on history, okay? Is the timing a little sus? Maybe. But honestly, both books were great, and they didn't feel similar at all. It's hard to say if she did know about the other book and wrote it based on an outline, but I really don't agree with the idea that she plagiarized it. Not even a little bit, okay? Okay, now I'm moving into something that I think we're going to start seeing a lot more of. Authors that use AI to partially write their novels. This one gives me the hardcore icks. I think if you need AI to write for you, you can't call yourself a writer. And I wouldn't be spending my hard-earned money on your garbage. Now, Casey Crown faces controversy after suspected ChatGPT prompts were found in their latest novel, sparking debates about AI's role in storytelling and author transparency. I am 100% with anyone who boycotts lazy authors. Now, I can understand using AI if you need help with sentence structure or maybe to proofread, but to actually write for you? No way. Now, she hasn't addressed whether or not she did use AI, and her fans are now at a crossroads. I don't believe AI should be used to create any form of artistic expression. It takes the individualism away, but then I am old, okay? How would you feel if your favorite painting wasn't painted by the artist? It would definitely change how you feel about it, I can guarantee it. It's hard to say if Casey did in fact use AI, but an author that has admitted to it wrote the book Tokyo 2 Dojo 2. Okay, this is a novelist, Dia Kudin, who uses AI to write her novel, Sympathy Tower Tokyo. I think that might be the English translation of the book. Suggested in an interview with the Japan News in April that humans can create novelty in a way AI cannot. The author does not mind her work being used to train AI. She won a prestigious award for the book too. Did she cheat? She is unapologetic for doing it and quite freely admits that at least 5% was written by AI. How would you feel if you were nominated for a prize and the winner admits to using AI? I'm going to guess you feel cheated. I get the feeling that more authors use AI than they care to admit, but how do you deal with plagiarism if you didn't write parts of your book? You know what? My freaking head hurts. Now, this last section I've dedicated to memoirs that turned out to be fabricated. This is one of the reasons why memoirs don't sell as well as they used to. You can't know for sure how much of the story you are reading is true and how much was added for entertainment or shock value. Now, I don't read many memoirs, but apparently there are a lot that have come under fire. I'm going to start with Lucky by Alison Sebold. This one wasn't so much that she lied, but her story ended up sending an innocent man to jail. She admits that she remembered some things wrong, and she's very sorry for what happened, but that doesn't change what happened to the man she accused of attacking her, and the fact that that book is still out there. Now, this one is a miscarriage of justice, but she didn't mean to cause harm, but she did, and she made money from it. Now, this isn't the only problematic book. A Million Little Pieces by James Frey. Now, he faced controversy in 2006 after an investigation website reported that he fabricated parts of his memoir. Oprah Winfrey, who had selected the book for her book club, confronted Frey on her show. Okay, so the Smoking Gun report. In January 2006, the Smoking Gun published an article alleging that Frey exaggerated or fabricated parts of his book. The article cited police reports, court records, and interviews with law enforcement. Okay. Winfrey confronted Frey on her show, calling him out for lying and betraying readers. Now, Frey admitted to altering details of his story, including the length of his jail sentence. Frey said he stood by the book as being the truth of his life. So the truth of how he feels about it, I guess, is good enough for him. He also said that Winfrey called him to apologize for feeling betrayed. The controversy raised questions about the authenticity of memoirs. Random House, the publisher of A Million Little Pieces, offered full refunds to anybody who purchased the book directly from them. Now, that sucks for Random House, but that just shows you that someone didn't do their job properly. Now, I've never read it, but I might now just to see. Now, this book I also haven't read, Three Cups of Tea. I'd actually never heard of it until people started talking about it in group. It's a book by Greg Mortensen and has been the subject of controversy over the claim that the book is inaccurate and that Mortensen mismanaged funds. So in 2011, 60 Minutes expose claimed that many of the schools Mortensen claimed to have built were empty. CBS alleged that Mortensen made up parts of the rescue story and took credit for building schools that didn't exist. The author of Three Cups of Deceit disputed Mortensen's accounts of experiences in Afghanistan and Pakistan. There were claims of financial mismanagement. A Montana Attorney General investigation found that Mortensen misspent over $6 million of Central Asia Institute funds. So he was accused of mishandling CAI funds. His response? He vehemently denies the claims made by 60 Minutes, but he did agree to repay $1 million back to the CAI. Now, that's insanity. Why publish a book when you've committed fraud? Ego is real, my friends, okay? Okay, so next up is an interesting story. So in 1971, a frustrated 54-year-old writer named Beatrice Sparks spoke directly to teens by masquerading as one of them. Her disguise came in the form of a book, Go Ask Alice, which was marketed as the real diary of a 15-year-old drug user. Alice is as hardcore as any book carrying the young adult label had ever been. And its contents was almost entirely invented by Sparks. As such, it is a riff with misinterpretations of drug effects that could reasonably be described as disinformation. To have read Go Ask Alice is to be duped. And more than 50 years after its release, nearly 6 million copies of the pop classic has been sold. Now, that is a lot of people it fooled, okay? The story behind the grift is spelled out in detail in Rick Emerson's new book, Unmask Alice. LSD, Satanic Panic, and the imposter behind the world's most notorious diaries. One of the taglines for the book is, truth is stranger than nonfiction. Now, I read Unmask Alice. It was a mind F and a half. So Go Ask Alice details its narrator's descent into addiction and exploitation. She runs away from home and becomes a strung out teenage sex worker before landing in a mental institution. She resolves to get clean, but the book ends with a tragic postscript stating that 3 weeks after her initial entry, the narrator relapsed and died. Now, this book was sensationalized because it was believed to be non-fiction. It was quite the scandal at the time. When it came out, and honestly, I've read it, you can tell the person writing the book had zero clue about taking drugs and the effects, but it did fool a lot of people. It felt more like a social experiment than a diary, and the author Beatrice attempted to double down on her line by saying they were pages from diaries of patients. What? So there you have it. There were so many more books I could have added, but honestly, unless I was planning on doing a 10-part series, I was never going to cover them all. These ones seem to have a lot of information online, and I tried to pick books and authors that I actually knew something about. Obviously, there are things about Neil Gaiman that are currently disturbing his fans, and AJ Finn told a lot of lies about his past too. It's all rather dark, and honestly, if you dig into someone's closet, you are likely to find things in there you would rather not know. Have you read any books that have been clouded in controversy? Did any books here shock you? Did you know about any of these? Let me know in the comments. I'm always interested to know what you think. I really hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please give me a hit on that subscribe button, youtube.com/@therightkindofbooktalk. You can always follow me on TikTok at right.kind.book.talk, Instagram at the right kind of book talk, Facebook at right kind book talk. You can check out my Etsy store, bookaloriandesigns.etsy.com. You can always email me at therightkindofbooktalk@gmail.com and give me feedback, maybe some topics you'd like to discuss, or maybe you want to come join me, film with me. Come on. I'm waiting for that one special person. You can find The Right Kind of Book Talk on Spotify, Apple Music, RSS, Apple Podcasts, Player FM, Amazon, and anywhere else you can find a podcast. Well, pretty much. I'm pretty sure there's probably places I've missed. Give me a follow on any of these and you could be in with a chance to win bookish prizes. Send a friend to my YouTube and they subscribe and you're already subscribing. You double your chance of winning. Guys, have the reading day you deserve and I will see you next week. This is Stacey Wright signing off from The Right Kind of Book Talk. Have a good one. Take care.